I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We finally got a taste of Donald Trump's tax returns from 20 years ago. They were leaked to and published by the New York Times, very much against his will. Are we okay with that? I mean, how would you feel if someone released your private documents to the world? Today, two ethical authorities join us to deconstruct the dilemmas of our modern lives. It's the return of the ethics professors. We'll get their thoughts on Trump's taxes, on the morals of some groundbreaking reproductive technology, and whether complaining about politics obligates us to vote. Later, Brian McTavish brings us his weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The ethics professors are here to dissect all sorts of moral quandaries later on this hour, but dealing with all sorts of municipal quandaries of their own this afternoon will be the Kansas City, Missouri Council. They've got a docket chock full of hot-button city issues today. Here to give us a rundown is 3rd District at-large Councilman Quentin Lucas. Councilman, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Well, big afternoon in store for the City Council. One of the most anticipated votes is on an ordinance you've been working hard on, which would overhaul the way the city gives tax breaks to developers. Give us a 30-second rundown on the main points of that.
So the main points of the ordinance is going to be step one, a cap on abatements at 75% of a property tax redirection, i.e. a new development will have to pay 25% of its property taxes instead of the sometimes 100% abatements or redirections or tax breaks over 20 to 25 years.
That's the big change, right?
That's a very significant change and one of the more significant changes in decades. And this has been requested largely from local school districts, Jackson County, yes, the public library, and a number of others. So we look forward to having a vote on that ordinance today. There are also exceptions for things like historic buildings, prevailing wage, and other such issues. So that's going to be a real exciting debate, we think, today in council.
You know, one of the biggest questions raised the last time the council discussed this, Quentin, was how it'll affect future development in Kansas City. What were your colleagues' concerns, and how have you responded to them?
You know, I think the first thing that folks wanted to know was, will this bring an end or at least address this public referendum effort in Kansas City? We've all gotten to a point where you can't have a project now without a threat of a public vote to try to slow it down, which really harms real estate. And so the first way I addressed my colleagues' concerns was saying that this is actually how we can speak to petitioners groups and others and say that we hear you and we hear your concerns and what you've been upset with. So the ordinance, as we discussed today, will have the support of the NAACP, Kansas City School District, Jackson County Executive Frank White, a number of others. So through collaboration, we think that's step one in how to address it. But in terms of making sure we keep the pipeline going, a lot of us are of the view that what we need to do to keep the pipeline going in Kansas City developed is to make sure we have an efficient and predictable development process for businesses. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we've seen in the ordinance is frankly, a very good path forward for how someone who's looking to build in Kansas City knows the groups they need to talk to, knows the types of abatements and incentives they should look at, and then knows what the council actually thinks about development, which is we want it to work, but we want to make sure we have good public-private partnerships.
And you're confident this is going to come to a final vote today, Councilman?
I am very confident of that. I talked to my colleagues today. We actually have a council majority that are sponsors of this ordinance. We'll also continue to work on a number of others, and that's what I'm doing with my morning and afternoon to make sure that this is something that they can be comfortable with.
Two other issues, separate proposals from the Intercontinental on the Plaza and the downtown Marriott Hotel to establish something called community improvement districts to help raise funds for renovations. If you can, break each of those down briefly for us.
So the Intercontinental issue is something called a community improvement district. It allows a property to tax itself. So this will be a 1% tax on folks who are buying anything at the Intercontinental, whether you're going there for a wedding or something like that, or most typically would be someone who's staying there in a hotel room.
So taxpayers across the city are not paying for this thing, right?
That's correct. That's correct. This is not a taxpayer-funded subsidy, and nor is this a taxpayer redirection. This is just money that is being spent at the Intercontinental, and it's only going to help fund Intercontinental improvements. And this is really, in a way, a surcharge on taxes. The controversy, of course, Steve, is that to accomplish this, they need a designation of blight. And blight on the plaza, and particularly at the Intercontinental Hotel, has been a tough pill to swallow for many on the council and many, I think, a vast majority of people in the public.
Right. And is the council ready to go along with that today?
You know, I think that's a toss-up. I spoke earlier in a public meeting this week. I prefer a delay in that discussion, at least so long as we know, well, why are we doing this, and do we have a real policy for when we're trying to create blight designations to address other hotel issues? As you'll probably ask in a question in a second, we have the Marriott Mühlbach.
Right.
We have Crown Center hotels, a number of large hotels that could seek these types of pursuits. Do we want to grant all of them? And this is a real policy concern I think we need to address in the future.
And that's exactly what's happening now, because the downtown Marriott wants a break as well.
That's exactly right. And theirs is a little different. At least in that deal, first, you don't need a blight designation. But this will be a use of some Convention and Visitors Bureau, our Convention and Visitors tax funds, that basically help for the improvement of the hotel itself. What the city gets out of it, unlike in the Intercontinental deal, is a number of parking spaces downtown, which are key, but then also a set of a room block in connection to future conventions and others. So we can actually make sure when we're marketing Kansas City, we can also market the Marriott Hotel and hotel rooms connected to it. One other really brief concern is that there are a number of other hotels. I mentioned Crown Center, but also the Plaza Marriott, that have said, me too. If
right.
you're thinking of all these creative ways to do these, then we want to make sure that we're part of it. And so that's the trouble council may find itself in sometime soon.
Quentin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much, and good luck this afternoon.
Thank you, Steve.
That's Kansas City, Missouri Councilman Quentin Lucas. Elections usually provide good fodder for ethics debates. Here's one. Was the New York Times right to release Donald Trump's tax documents, knowing that Trump has steadfastly refused to do so? Tax returns, after all, are not public documents. Here's another question brought to us courtesy of Election 2016. If we're going to complain about our politics and politicians, then aren't we obligated to be part of the solution? That might involve voting, to be sure, and maybe also engage with a campaign, perhaps, advocate for a cause, or even, heaven forbid, run for office. We'll kick those ideas around this morning, and we'll also talk about the ethics of creating designer babies in the wake of last week's announcement of the birth of a three-parent baby using a process called spindle nuclear transfer. More on that in just a little later. But first, politics and ethics, and with us to talk about it are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics, and he's one of my bosses over at UMKC. Wayne, good to have you. Welcome
back. Good
to
be here.
The Reverend Dane Summer is also here. He's director of spiritual service at Children's Mercy Hospital. He counsels patients and clinicians at the hospital regarding the ethical issues in organ transplantation and does ongoing work on the theology of suffering. Reverend Summer, nice to have you too.
It
Welcome,
is great
Dane.
To be here today.
Well, you know, voters tend to point their fingers at politicians and public officials for all the failings of our political system, Wayne. But politicians didn't nominate Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Voters did, regular people. Have you lost sight of our collective responsibilities here somehow? Yes, is
well,
the answer, Wayne.
Yes.
Thank
you. Yes, I think we have. You know, some voters did. Actually, a very small percentage of people were responsible for the nominations of the two candidates.
Because a lot of folks didn't vote.
A lot of folks didn't vote, but just the processes by which those votes happen, they're not primaries in every state. There are these caucuses. It's difficult. It's not a methodology that easily makes it readily available for voters to get out and actually to participate in the process, at least in some cases. And so I think that is one of the actual ethical quandaries around the whole process is, you know, if we're going to make people responsible for and say you're responsible for getting out and voting and participating in the electoral process, Are there obstacles that are preventing ordinary and average citizens who might have difficulties participating in that process from actually doing it, from being able to make meaningful decisions? And so there are voter drives, and there are attempts in a lot of states to try to get people to the polls. And then there are things that seem to be going on that try to block or prevent certain people from getting to the polls who would like to participate. So I don't think there is, as with most of these ethical quandaries, there's not one simple problem or one simple issue there. You certainly have a lot of people who are readily available to get out and vote who don't and want to sit back and be hypercritical but don't really want to make any positive change to the process. And that's equally troublesome as well. So I think within the gamut of what the responsibilities are, and if you think about a liberal democracy, what we are talking about are voters, and the very concept of a democracy imposes certain rights, which a lot of people like to talk about what their rights are, but it places squarely on the electorate, on the voters, on the people who live in a liberal democracy, a lot of responsibilities.
Yeah.
Responsibilities that had been transferred from the monarchies of past to the people who now give rise to government. And upon that, they encumber upon themselves certain responsibilities, and they have responsibility to live up to whatever those would be.
So. Let me get our listeners involved here. Are regular citizens getting off too lightly here when it comes to their responsibilities in a democracy, as Wayne Vaught just talked about? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dane, what do you think? I mean, has there been a disconnect between, you know, regular folks out there and what the government does? And, you know, this notion that I've always seen democracy and government, it's kind of a contact sport, both literally, meaning getting in contact with your officials, and engaging in some way with the government that oversees you. That's how democracy is supposed to work, isn't it?
Yeah, well, certainly. And I think it does go right back to that concept of democracy, that we are all working together. Everybody in this nation is called. There's almost an imperative to that we all work together. Some would say that imperative comes from God or a supreme being, and that we have a manifest destiny to be who we are. And I think we've lost that sense of democracy, that we're all working for the good of the country. And
where did that idea go? Yeah, I agree with you. Where did
it go? And we become so adversarial. So that, you know, it might be rooted in a two-party system, where it is almost like putting two parties in a boxing ring and having to go toe-to-toe. But even in my lifetime, in our lifetimes, we've seen this change where people are engaged, people are truly empowered to be involved in democracy, and there's this a huge split that has occurred, so that it has become so adversarial between the parties. And I think that's the challenge of our day. You pick sides, and we've created a culture where anything goes, and it's created bitterness. It's created toxin. All we have to do is look at the verbiage in the last two debates to see that it's, you know, we're not working together on this. And I think that does impact the individual voter, the individual citizen who's trying to do their duty.
So you're implying here, who wants to engage in a system when it's that adversarial, when it's that confrontational? A lot of people run from that. They don't gravitate toward it.
Well, there's a malaise that sits in, or there's a sense of pessimism that comes in. I think of the many, many people who can't affiliate with either of the two primary presidential candidates there, and who are probably simply going to opt out of voting. And it's not so much the policies that they're talking about, but it's the personalities, and the name calling, and the aggression that's being expressed by people in politics, and that's a sad thing.
Wayne, what do the great philosophers say about, you know, the duties of citizens in a democracy to take part in their government? Because I know there's been a lot of heavy thinking out there about this, and it's important.
Well, it is, and I mean, if you go back to the Socratic period, Plato in particular was particularly opposed to democracy.
Is that right?
Yeah, he felt, and in part because it was a consequence of the trial of Socrates, and he saw what a democracy could do, the voting and the wrongful prosecution and conviction and execution of Socrates, made him highly skeptical of whether democracies could effectively work.
Mm-hmm.
And so was very adamantly opposed in the sense that they're what you need are the sort of the philosopher kings, the rulers who were benevolent dictators who would be able to address and understand and make decisions, and that democracies tended to have a tendency to create, well, what we're seeing is that there's this polarization, that you have the vote of the majority and the will of the majority may not reflect necessarily what's the right thing, what is the good things to do, that there can be certainly an ability to overlook obligations to the poor and to the people who are incapable of sort of fending for themselves. So democracies certainly have their challenges, and the philosophers have certainly looked disturbingly at that. On the other hand, the question is there maybe this is the least worst of the possible systems of governance that we could have. And so other philosophers have certainly taken that perspective.
Interesting.
While democracy is certainly not a perfect system by any means, it's a lot better than some of the other things that we have, other ways in which governance has been executed and people have been governed in the past. So
don't you wonder if some of these guys could come back today and spend a week and look around this country? You wonder what they would say.
Right, the Thomas Jeffersons, the John Lockes, advocates of democracy in the Enlightenment period, when there were when you had the very basic fundamental principles that really were codified in our Constitution, which were taken from these Enlightenment philosophers, the ideas of democracy, the right of the people, the Danaes referred to God. I mean, even in previous monarchies, the rule or the authority has always been seen to come to God. That is, the monarchs had the authority directly from God, and it was upon that divine anointment that they executed their governance. And what you have with the democracy in the United States is that the power of government isn't seen as coming from God, maybe God through the people, but the people are the ones who give power to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a fundamental shift in thinking about how governments are then run, and certainly different than what we would see from a Platonic worldview.
Right.
And so this is coming back to the very question that we asked at the beginning, is that if that's going to be the case, if the people are actually empowering the government, giving the government its power, what then responsibilities do they have to ensure that the government's acting in a way that's ethically defensible and appropriate? And from there, we get into a lot of controversy.
I hope our listeners will call. That's the question on the table here. What obligation, if any, do you feel to engage in your government these days? Is it something you feel comfortable doing, or has it gotten so adversarial that you don't want to do it? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Dane, I'm wondering if we could flip this around for a moment. If people don't take part in democracy, even by doing as little as voting, do they have any standing to then complain about the outcome of an election or the actions of an elected leader, even the president?
Well, I think this is the wrong answer. This is not the answer that I see the gleam in your eye. You're hoping that I'll say. I think in the United States, in America, that we always have the right to free speech, and we can always articulate that. And I wouldn't want to impinge on that. I think there is an element of this that even people who are commenting in a negative way, even in a toxic way, I think they're adding something to our democracy. We need to hear those voices. I need to hear the voice of the people with whom I disagree politically. Mm-hmm. And so I would never want to put a lid on that or suggest that that there's a mandate that you have to vote if you're going to be involved in this.
But on the other side, let me
contradict myself. The other side is one of the things that I use in my daily work with patients and families at the hospital that is helpful. It actually comes from a theologian, Paul Tillich, and he talks about the dialectic of and he calls it individuation and participation. So take those two words. What do we do in our lives so that we are that we can claim the essence of who we are as individuals, mm-hmm. so that we can be the person that God created us to be, or be the person that that walks on the street and does what they want to do, and maximize our potential as human beings, or simply be who we are, and all of that. But he says that needs to be balanced out by participation, in getting out of yourself to be connected with others and participating in something that is greater than yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's a theological concept, but I certainly use that same thing in terms of our political participation, because there's a sense of we're I think, we all know the phrase, all politics is local.
Mm-hmm.
I could say all politics is individual, too. How's it going to impact me?
Mm-hmm.
How do I feel when I hear that one of the candidates hasn't paid taxes for a long time and I'm called to pay taxes? You know, it really is all about me and my opinions. But I think at the same time, it's always in a democracy about reaching out beyond ourselves and
that's interesting.
And participating in this great experiment that we have.
Susan from Kansas City, Missouri. Susan, welcome to Up to Date.
Good morning, Steve.
Hi.
Good to hear from you again. Hi. I think that everyone is obligated to register to vote. I think that they're obligated to go to the voting even for the local school elections. They're also obligated to, when they have a problem on any level of government, to fully engage. It doesn't stop and start at registering to vote and voting every 4 years, every 2 years. You have to be fully active every time. And it isn't all about you. I'm a little freaked out about that. I'm glad you expounded upon it. It is your needs and your interests are there, but also you have to reach beyond and say, wait a minute, all this noise I'm hearing right now, I have to take pause because I'm a strong liberal. I'm not mm-hmm. a progressive. I'm a strong liberal. But I'm listening to the people that are totally opposite of me because they're not aliens that plop down here. Something in our democracy has gone so terribly wrong that we're polarized, and I just can't be a part of the shouting.
Right.
I have to sit and listen and say, how can I help this process so that we do become, after the election, how do I help us, me individually, bring my little circle of influence together again.
Right.
Because we can't keep shouting. The shouting is driving me nuts. But again, all levels. And then after the election, you have to keep in contact with your politicians.
Right.
Who are now your elected officials, and keep their feet to the fire. Or when they need your help, be ready to do the helping.
Susan, I appreciate that. Susan used an interesting word, Wayne, obligation. Dale has written a call from his car to say this to us. If you don't participate, then you can't complain, and you can't expect your interest to be represented. So my question is there a moral obligation to vote? Is that a standard that citizens have to meet under a moral umbrella, moral obligation, in your view?
A moral obligation to be engaged and participate, I think, is something we could argue. Is there a moral obligation to actually get out and vote? You know, Dane made the comment earlier that there are probably a lot of people in the United States disgusted with all of the candidates that are
I think I may have heard that sentiment a few times
It's true. And so they are going to exercise their right not to vote, not to participate, and some of it may be because of fatigue, because they feel that their vote is worthless, that what is it going to mean if I get out and do this? And so there will be those who will vote for not one of the two primary candidates, but one of the alternate candidates.
Right.
So there will be people who will be casting their votes in different ways. I don't know. I mean, there are a variety of reasons why a person might not vote. So I think it would be difficult for me to say that there's an absolute moral obligation to get out and vote in each election. There could be reasons why someone's exercising a moral right not to vote and mm-hmm. say I'm objecting on these grounds and have a reason for doing it. But I don't think that excuses one from participating in a meaningful way in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, it can be a very local level, a very public, a very national level, however it might be. You know, the difficulty becomes the people who aren't meaningfully engaged in trying to solve the problems that we collectively have as a city or as a country, whatever level that we're working on, and don't try to do things that are making progressive and, mm-hmm. and positive change. And some of that is just about, you know, can be getting out of the community, going to, you know, council okay. meetings, doing all sorts of things. But then the other component of this, and I think it's something that we overlook, is, you know, the role of the educational process in this and support for that. And we're seeing a lack of support, I think, particularly for public higher education and public education more generally. One of the fundamental foundations of a liberal democracy is an educated populace, an mm-hmm. educated voting group. And if you don't have people who can parse through all of the complex media splash that they're getting in this election, and I think none of us can probably really get to the truth of almost any given issue, but mm-hmm. to really to be able to understand, to synthesize, to make educated votes, that's something that I think that we have an obligation to try to ensure that people do. Having an educational system that allows people to do that is something that's also incumbent upon us, as a society, to promote this democracy.
Rudy tweeted this, "I vote because my great-grandmothers could not. One was Cherokee," he writes. Arnold, who's visiting from North Carolina. Arnold, welcome to Kansas City. Nice to have you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm listening to this discussion, and I hear everyone has an opinion, and my whole point is I think it's cowardly not to vote as a citizen, because at the end of the day you're going to have to live with whomever is in charge, and so you've got to make a decision, and so you have to step up and figure out which candidate has more of what you're concerned about, and which one provides you the best opportunity to pursue the America that you believe we deserve.
So you think it's an obligation to vote, Arnold? If I'm hearing you right.
Absolutely, I think it is an obligation. It's one of the obligations that's been fought for by many people. As a matter of fact, it's the core of our nation's belief. And based upon your ethnicity, it is something that if you don't understand how the vote affects you, then you really don't necessarily deserve to even be allowed to vote. So you have to vote. You have to vote. And then you have the right then to go ahead and disagree
right.
with policies that are derived. Yes.
Okay. Arnold, I appreciate the thoughts very much. Thank you. Time for a break here. When we come back, was the New York Times right to release Donald Trump's tax documents, knowing that Trump has steadfastly refused to do so? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we asked if civility can be brought back into politics, and we examined the history behind the present-day racial divide in Forsyth County, Georgia. Find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, a road trip through the years of the Brat Pack as we travel to the locations of teen movies of the 1980s. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, today we're talking about ethics with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught from UMKC, Reverend Dane Summer from Children's Mercy Hospital. Gentlemen, let's move on and talk about Donald Trump, because everybody else is talking about Donald Trump. Last week, the New York Times got a hold of Donald Trump's tax returns from 1995 that revealed that the Republican nominee had declared a $916 million loss on his income tax returns that year. Consequently, he could have avoided paying any federal income taxes for 18 years. Was the New York Times right to release the Trump tax documents it received, knowing that Trump himself had refused to do so? What do you think, Dane?
Well, I think there's a couple of pieces here, and one is he's running for president. I think, at least in my mind, and maybe this isn't fair, that everything is open in terms of.
But even a private document like this?
I think so. I think that if we can look at the notion of his finances and get some understanding of it, if he wanted to remain a bit of a recluse in terms of his finances and all that, he didn't need to run for president. So I trust that.
That's a private document, though. Yeah. The government can't come into my house, or a reporter can't come into my house and grab my tax returns.
You're not running
for
president either. And,
yeah. But where's the law that says if I'm running for president, then that information is public?
Well, I think it's an attitude. I think it's simply the what you sign on to when this sorts of things. I'm sure that in the upcoming debate, we're going to hear some rather sordid details of personal intimacies that have occurred, and I know that eventually is going to come out. And is that fair? Is that right? No, it's not. I think it was fair. The issue for me is it goes back actually to the Declaration of Independence, and I think that this is why it causes so much consternation for so many people. I read the Declaration of Independence every 4th of July, and I always pause with a little bit of humility at the very last phrase of the Declaration,
which
says that we will pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our honor to this experiment of becoming the United States.
That's interesting.
And it really feels as though, again, this is a cultural issue. It feels as though the way this is being played and the way it came out in the first presidential debate, that there's a general reluctance to pay taxes. There's a he leaned over. He said, "It's because I'm smart." And I think that as the president, as the commander in chief, as the person who's going to be leading our nation, I think he needs to redefine his sense of patriotism, which is, we engage in this, and we shouldn't be. We shouldn't be afraid of the fact that we all have an obligation to pay taxes to the country.
Let me get our listeners involved here. Was Donald Trump obligated to turn over those documents or not? 816-235-2888. Tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. What do you think, Wayne? Was he obligated or not?
Well, it seems that there's no requirement.
He's talking about suing the Times for releasing it.
He absolutely is, and I understand that there's some interesting.
But he wants to sue everybody.
Of course.
I'm surprised he's not suing me.
Yeah. He may now.
He probably will now.
Give him some time.
I think that there has been some interesting legal debate about this issue. The New York Times is pushing the First Amendment rights and that they have critical information that they needed to disclose, and then there were questions about, well, this package just kind of miraculously showed up at their doorstep, and this is information that the public really needs to know, and we didn't steal it from Donald Trump, but it's vital information for the public interest, and so I have an obligation as a newspaper to publish information that's vital for the public record. Now, it just doesn't seem to me right that things just kind of show up at the New York Times. Maybe somebody decided that that's what they want to do.
Maybe it was stolen.
I'm sure it wasn't taken with his permission.
He didn't hand it to somebody.
He did not say, here, please, could you FedEx
deliver
this
to
the New York Times for me? So it's done, obviously, against his will. He's protested it. I think it is illegal to publish federal tax returns without the person's permission. That's established. Whether this First Amendment will have any traction, I don't know. It'd be interesting if there's some attorneys out there who could chime in and talk about it. My general sense is that it's wrong to do something that's clearly illegal and violates the personal privacy of an individual, even someone running for president of the United States. But the question is whether the American people should have demanded this. I mean, it's something that has been done historically.
Democrats did.
He wouldn't do it. And you would think, well, look, if this is someone who's running for office and they refuse to do X, then why is he garnering so many votes and so much support in terms of the people who say, well—
They let voters make up their own minds about that.
Make your mind about what it is and why he's doing it. And certainly I think that there were reasons to push it and push it as an issue. Now, do we want to make it a requirement that, you know, if you're going to run for president, that there would be a law that requires every presidential candidate to disclose their income taxes so that the people would have it? We find ourselves in this awkward quagmire because we don't have such a law. We do have a law that protects privacy. We do have laws that protect the income taxes. The Times got this and published it. It is clearly something that I think was advantageous, but this is where we get into in the ethics debates about this utilitarian sort of quandary, is that the fact that it might be to the public's best interest and the greater good is served by releasing his tax returns because people get now a perspective of really who is this guy, violates what Kant would call these fundamental rights that we have to treat him as an individual, as a person, as an entity deserving of certain types of respect, and violating protections and rights that we would, as you say, afford any other person who would have had this happen to without specific laws requiring him to do so, I think really creates an ethical challenge. So I would distance myself a little bit from Dane's comment. I do find some ethical, at least initial prima facie ethical problems that I haven't been persuaded that the Times had enough ethical support behind it for publishing those without his approval.
Let's go to some calls here. Rick from Kansas City, Missouri. Rick, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the discussion.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely, I don't know what other kind of document gets published if it's not a private one. I mean, what if it was already a public document, what would be the point in releasing and publishing the paper? It may be a tax return, but it's not the government that released it. It's an accountant or somebody somewhere. And all kinds of private documents over the decades have been released and published by newspapers if they're found to be in the public interest. And certainly this is a public, you know, somebody that's running for the highest public office in the land. So you can go back decades, people's things about their health, things about their private finances, they're all private documents.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been released and published in the paper. That's a scoop. That's a story. That's, you know, to say that somebody said earlier that what right does the government have to release my taxes? The government did not release his taxes. An accountant gave him 3 pages and sent him anonymously. And I mean,
Rick, we don't know who released who gave the documents to the New York Times. I mean, it could have been the IRS. We don't know.
Yeah, that's true. They don't know where it came from. But I think there's a long tradition of newspapers publishing things that are sent to them that are viewed to be in the public interest, and they are certainly private documents. And in the larger issue of the press looking more closely at Donald Trump, it's long overdue. You know, he will make statements that are noticeably false, and you know, the other day when he said that Hillary Clinton did the birther thing.
Okay, well, that's a little bit of a different – and, Rick, I appreciate it. That's a little bit of a different issue. And there's a distinction here, isn't there, you know, Dane, between, you know, the release of a report the government has deemed to be private and someone's personal financial information that is personal to them only. There is a distinct. I mean, I'm thinking of the Pentagon Papers that were released back in the early 1970s about the Vietnam War. That's sort of one private thing that might have been released. A tax, you know, your tax documents in a different category, isn't it?
I don't see it so much, and you know, I really appreciate what Wayne has said, and I think that if we can acknowledge that there are. Ethical reasons to protect someone's privacy. As someone who works in a hospital, HIPAA is my god. You know, in terms of not releasing personal private health information, and we have to follow that. But I think it, Mr. Trump's in a different category because mm-hmm. he's running for the highest office in
gotcha.
Our country,
mm-hmm.
and the rules. Some of these rules are the bet's just off on it.
Let me go to David from Overland Park. David, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. So my comment is that I find it revolting that Donald Trump has the ability to pay his taxes. He has the money, and he's not. And I find it very. And there are many low-income people who can't afford to pay their taxes who are being forced to, or if they don't, are being ridiculed for it.
Well, he wasn't obligated. Apparently, he may not have been obligated to pay any more taxes because of his big loss back in the mid-1990s.
Yeah, true. But I think that was a loophole that was created for failing businesses, and I don't believe his business was failing at the time.
But we don't know that, though, do we?
True. We don't. That is true. But I think if he would talk openly about this, we could come to the truth.
Okay. David, I appreciate the comments. Thank you. Let me go to Joe from Lenexa. Joe, you're on UpToDate with our ethics professors. Good morning.
I do not know if the New York Times was legally allowed to do this, but I'm glad that they did it, that the press is finally doing their job of investigating very important matters for the American people so that we can make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you very much, Joe. What other thoughts do you have?
Well, you know, I think it's one of the things that's most interesting about this, and coming back to the issue of privacy, is that the income tax issue, I think, is quite relevant to the presidency and the way he's built himself up. A lot of the things that really expose private issues about candidates have almost nothing relevant. The things that Trump has wanted to constantly bring up, and you know, bringing up about now, about the affairs that Bill Clinton had back. Okay, let's go back and talk about those. Those are quite intimately private and
That's
things
right.
that we would think should be protected. And I'm not sure from Trump's perspective, really, that he has a whole lot. You would talk about complaining. I mean, this is the same candidate who was praising the Russian. Whoever agencies that were hacking into and inviting them, please hack into Hillary Clinton's private email accounts
so that
we can get information about her. And I want to expose that, but now I'm going to get upset if somebody hacks into my private life.
Although Trump did say at one point in the campaign early on that he would release this stuff.
He did, and we're getting pretty close to the election time, and we haven't had that information disclosed. So there's a lot of hypocrisy that's going on in this process. There's a lot of private information that's being splattered about. Am I glad that the Times did what they did? Some of the callers said, I probably am. I think that information needs to be out there. It's just ethically troublesome the way that we have allowed or required it to have been disclosed.
And see, I think that we have to acknowledge that no one is saying that he did anything illegal with his taxes,
correct.
That he took advantages of loopholes that are there. It's just the attitude. It is that, part of being a true patriot is mm-hmm. that we accept the reality of supporting our government mm-hmm. and paying taxes.
Well, we're going to leave our conversation there. We didn't get to the ethics around designer babies. We're going to save that one for next time because it's loaded and it's right down your pike, Wayne,
your
specialty there. I want to thank Wayne Vaught, the Dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences, the Reverend Dane Summer, Director of Spiritual Service at Children's Mercy Hospital. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Appreciate Thanks for
it.
Having us.
It's been great. Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
There's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you, 'cause it hangs them up to see someone. Make your own kind of music.
There's going to be a lot of music getting made this weekend. Brian McTavish is here, talks about cool stuff to do on your weekends. He's a KCUR contributor, and you want to talk about Porch Fest, and I love Porch Fest. Just love it.
Well, Steve,
it's
tell
a neat
us.
Event. No, you. No, that's why we pay you the big money. You come in here and tell us. Yeah. Now, there's a topic.
Oh,
there's an ethical
a
conversation for you.
That's right.
Yeah.
Who gets the big money and why? Yeah. Well, I gotta confess.
Well,
I love the idea of Porch Fest.
I do too.
But this may be the first year I can actually love my memories of Porch Fest. I've never been.
We should go.
Have you?
Yes, several times.
Then you must tell us.
Well, it's just a great event. I mean, it's walking along the street and all these different musical groups playing on the front porches of houses that have, you know, agreed to have them come play, and there's nothing like it in town. It's great.
So what do you need me for?
Well,
You've
much today.
You've explained it.
Well,
you've
go.
Explained it. Let me go. Okay. This year it's bigger, more porchier, if you will.
And different location, too.
Yeah, it was in this West Plaza neighborhood.
That's right.
Now it's in the Valentine neighborhood.
A little north and little east.
Well,
yeah.
Just think like behind or just to the east of the up, or just west of the Uptown Theater there between Southwest Traffic Way and Broadway, north of Westport. Anyway, and it's not just 5 hours this year, it's 6 hours. It goes from 11 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, but good luck clearing them out. It's Porch Fest. Mama Cass Elliott not available for this gig, unfortunately.
Too bad.
But everything from Americana, really, that is too bad. What a voice.
Yeah.
Everything from Americana to Zydeco. And they play for tips. All these musicians, 140 bands, mostly acoustic, but, you know, they get to amplify their stringed instruments. But, you know, bring a few bucks for the tips, and they'll have food trucks, and my goodness, what a good time. And maybe next year I can tell you about what I think, because I'll be there this year, huh?
Good for you.
Yes, yes.
Together again, my tears have stopped.
Is that Emmy Lou?
Yeah.
Sure it is.
You bet it is.
Yeah.
Nobody sounds like her.
Yeah, no kidding.
But you're going to get the real thing.
The real thing.
The real thing. The real Emmy Lou. Not just those who would aspire to sound as sweet and wonderful and pure as Emmy Lou Harris when she headlines a Concerts for Refugees fundraiser.
She'll, a great lineup. Just a terrific
lineup.
Oh, my
gosh. Yeah. Country, folk, roots rock, singer-songwriters.
Steve Earle, Patty Griffin.
Oh, yeah.
Buddy Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Milk Carton Kids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know who's not going to be there at 8 o'clock Saturday night at Helzberg Hall at the Kaufman Center?
Ooh.
I hate to be a downer.
Who?
What's his name? It's Led Zeppelin's old rock god, Robert Plant.
Oh.
So I'm fiddling around looking for stuff.
Is he going to be here?
Oh, get this. This is like, it's probably causing a deep pain for some.
Well, it's starting to cause me some pain.
Okay, it's an 11-city tour that Emmy Lou is headlining, right? It was kind of her brainchild, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just the other day, I'm noodling around online, and guess what? There's the news that Robert Plant, he's going to be at 7 of the 11 cities.
Oh, you're kidding.
Now, never say never. It's not Saturday night yet, right? It's not happening yet. So he could just slip in, he said. That's not going to happen. That's never know.
You never know.
But it's plenty fun. It's plenty good. A rare opportunity to hear these people quietly and meaningfully communicate their inner voice.
And it's a benefit.
It's a benefit, yeah. It's going to help people who are refugees get educated and get back on their feet, whether they're living in a camp someplace or an urban area all over the world. It's a great cause and some great singer-songwriters.
You bet. Be sure to see Brian's 6 optimistic things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
Once upon a time, I had a little money. Got from my really stupid lobby fund. Even to you, still, you are the only one. I can't let it slip away. Super the man with the ticker tape tries to take it. This is what I'm going to say. Blame it all.
Tell us about him.
Well,
Elvis is in the house.
Yeah, tickets still left to see the great Elvis Costello.
No kidding. No
who kind of blew my little mind back in 1977 with My Aim Is True. That was his first album. And, you know, we thought he was a punk rocker. He was.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned out to be so much more.
That's right.
Right? I mean,
that's
he's really explored a lot. I mean, he's played with string quartets, and he's investigated the soul thing and the country thing. And he'll touch on a little of all of those things, I think, when he performs Saturday night, 7 o'clock, Yardley Hall at the Carlson Center. Where else but Johnson County Community College? A true impresario. Here's the gimmick on this. Did I say gimmick?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, Elvis. The way in here is that he's on his solo detour.
Oh.
Detour, concert tour. So the detour is that he's actually performing more or less solo. So he'll switch between guitar and piano, and then he knifes in these autobiographical stories, which what works out nicely because he recently published an autobiography of sorts.
How convenient.
Where he has childhood memories and the live show. He's got lots of family photos. His dad was a band leader in England. 7 o'clock Saturday, opening act, Larkin Poe. They will get on stage with him, and they will sing some of these great Elvis songs, too.
All right. What do we have here?
Well, that's actually Shakira.
This has been overlooked, this event.
This event?
Yes.
That's why we're not overlooking it.
Yes.
But this is actually, I found this, I guess I missed it, but Shakira, she had the official song of the 2016 Summer Olympic Games in Rio. This is called Try Everything. It's a perfect theme as well for the Tour of Gymnastics Champions 2016, in which we get a lot of great gymnasts doing all those wonderful flips and flies and what have yous at 7 o'clock Friday at the Sprint Center.
And the gold medal winner is going to be here.
We got five gold medal winners. And they're actually called the Final Five, or the Big Five, or whatever you want to call it. But you're talking about
Simone's going to be here.
Biles, who is the individual all-around vault and floor gold medalist.
Allie's going to be here, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It'll be fun.
It's going to be really cool. And they're all doing things that we would never try in a million years.
We have here, is that Taco Cat?
Wow.
Taco Cat.
You just read that, didn't you?
Never heard of him before. Yeah.
Well, they hate the weekend, which I think could be a great semi-ironic theme song for this segment in the future.
There you go.
Do you hate the weekend?
Not as much
as we do. Okay, we love the weekend. Yes, that's Taco Cat,
Taco
Seattle,
Cat. Where did that
Washington.
Name come from?
Well, it's a palindrome. And what is a palindrome, you ask? It's spelled the same way, backwards and forwards. Taco Cat. Try it at home, kids. Feminist, pop, punk, party music. 8 o'clock Saturday, Jackpot Music Hall in Lawrence. Ramones meets the Monkees. Have fun.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, we look at some of the most iconic movies of the 80s and the places where they happened. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.